Welcome back to Poetry and Everything. I'm your host, Judith Arcana. On this show, we'll have guests who are Portland poets, nearby poets, faraway poets, pairs of poets, groups of poets, maybe even folks who are not poets, but everybody is going to be reading and talking about poetry and everything on this show. Ground rules, I'll almost always read some of my own work at the beginning. I'll definitely always read the work of other folks. And of course, whoever the guests are on the show will be reading their own work and talking with me about poetry and everything. Tonight's piece by Judith Arcana, tonight's poem that I'm going to read, is called "There's a Bakery Where the Library Used to Be." And I just want to point out that, or let you know, that it was written for and about the old Hollywood Library in the Hollywood District of Portland, which is now the Fleur-de-Lis Bakery and Cafe, owned by Greg Mistel and his wife Lisa. And this piece was first published in a very fine but very short-lived journal called Portland Upside in 2009. And soon it will be found in Van Nuys, California. This will be at the end of October. It'll either appear on an umbrella or a water bottle label or a piñata at the Nevermore Project, run by Nikhil Davis, who's an amazing poet, an amazing human, actually. Okay, so there's a bakery where the library used to be. So the baker is an English major, and his gingerbread's shining lemon glaze rhymes with apricot scones, cinnamon rolls, thick brownies demanding haiku-sized bites. And those fat donuts are classics, their holes suggesting absent clues in mystery novels whose pages flutter like flaky pastry around sticky elements of the plot. Each berry tart tells a story. Each cookie's a simple sentence. Its crunchy sugar sparkles scattered like commas through paragraphs, like dashes for emphasis. And the very last crumb on the plate is a period or exclamation point or formally postmodern question mark. When the baker is an English major, then stone ground grain can be a metaphor, and characters can be yeasty, strong, salty citizens who grow thoughtfully into goodness, work to make it come out right, study recipes, learn to combine necessary flavors and textures. One character gets punched down, but rises, shapes up, reveals a heart as rich as dark rye. The narrator is sharp as a well-kept knife. Every chapter seems a slice of real life, all its ingredients mixed well. All the words are folded carefully into fiction, memoir, sonnets, cooling on stacked metal trays, shelved there like the books were, always bound to feed us. And now I get to introduce my wonderful guest for this evening, A.M. O'Malley, no doubt familiar to many of you. A.M. O'Malley lives here in Portland, in Oregon, where she is the executive director of the Independent Publishing Resource Center. Her writing has appeared in various journals, including Nailed Magazine, Poor Claudia, and the Burnside Review. This year, her first full-length book of poems came out, called Expecting Something Else. And as you'll see when you read, as you will, Expecting Something Else, it's one of the classic literary and cinematic exercises. That is to say, it's quote unquote based on a true story, a story told in a voice that bumps up the cliche. It literally leaps off the page into something real, something true. And one of the notes on the book jacket, which I want to cite for you folks, is this: O'Malley breaks from traditional forms to tell her story with a hybrid of narrative and lyricism and explores the possibilities that happen when form is broken. And that, it struck me when I was reading it, and I have had the pleasure of hearing her read from it as well, that the breaking of form is also, in a sense, its content, one of its primary subjects. So welcome, A.M. O'Malley.
Thank you, Judith Arcanin. Thank you, KBOO Community Radio.
It's great to have you on the show.
I'm so happy to be here.
So now both of us will read poems by other people. Other people to enlarge the studio and enlarge the listening audience's experience. You want to go first? Read a few poems?
I'd love to. I have a couple poems, two poems. One is, the first one I'll read is by C.D. Wright, who is an important poet to me. She died this last year, and so I've been revisiting her work quite a bit. And this poem is the first poem of hers that I ever read. And I actually did a sort of translation of it, translation poem of it, and parts of it are in my book. So,
excellent.
It's called Personals. Personals. Some nights I sleep with my dress on. My teeth are small and even. I don't get headaches. Since 1971 or before, I have hunted a bench where I could eat my pimento cheese in peace. If this were Tennessee and across that river, Arkansas, I'd meet you in West Memphis tonight. We could have a big time. Danger, shoulder soft. Do not lie or lean on me. I'm still trying to find a job for which a simple machine isn't better suited. I've seen people die of money. Look at Admiral Benbow. I wish, like certain fishes, we came equipped with light organs. Which reminds me of a little-known fact. If we were going the speed of light, this dome would be shrinking while we were gaining weight. Isn't the road crooked and steep? In this humidity, I make repairs by night. I'm not one among millions who saw Monroe's face in the moon. I go blank looking at that face. If I could afford it, I'd live in hotels. I won awards in spelling and the Australian crawl long, long ago. Grandmother married a man named Ivan. The men called him Eve. Stranger, to tell the truth, in dog years, I'm up there. Oh, I love that poem.
Wonderful, wonderful. What else you got?
So this other poem I want to read is written by Grant Gerald Miller, and he is a collaborator of mine and a dear, dear friend. And the book I'm working on right now is actually a collaboration with him.
Excellent.
And for a long time now, we've been sending each other a poem every day. And so this is one of the poems of the day that I particularly love. It's called The Other Side of This Day. You followed me south. I slept in the hollow of your breath. I slept in your dried blood, a deep hinged sleep, void of the snakes of my fears. I learned what morning was after years of clenched nights. I learned what your skin was after years of watching your flickering mouth. Our children are now tall trees stacked on top of each other. This morning I heard a sound in the other room. You were making eggs on the other side of this day. I got rained on twice. Thick sheets soaked through and weighed me down. I tried to forget you. I wrapped myself in your handwriting, tried to make new phrases out of you, to float down the shifting riverbanks of ourselves on the life raft of your words. Still, you held me under, your soft fingers on my throat. This is the first death I've looked forward to. My blood on your palms. My periphery fading white. The petrifying earths of your eyes, the last thing I see. Yeah.
These things you two are sending back and forth, they're not light things. They're seriously layered.
Yeah, layered is a good word for it.
Complexity, we love it. The piece I'm going to read is by Lori Jekiela, and she does a few things that I really appreciate. One in particular that's notable in this piece is she talks about very heavy stuff and is funny at the same time. Just like life, right? Mm. If you don't already know, I'll tell you here, Lori Jacquiela is or was for a long time a flight attendant, and this poem comes out of that experience. It's called The Lady in 38C Thinks I'm Her Nurse. Nurse, she yells. Nurse, my finger. I bring her a Band-Aid and put it on, though she's fine. Oh, thank you, nurse, she yells. You're a good one. She winks and smiles, and the woman next to her glares into her computer. I think the old lady's charming. She's 86, still pretty. Her eyes are blue. Her hair is a cloud. She looks exactly like what's outside. She's the only air in this cabin, the only light. Nurse, she yells. And I look back over the sad heads, eggs in a carton, faces pressed against the mite-ridden blankets and pillows they fought for. And there she is, beaming. Nurse, she says, where are we? I take her hand and look out the window. I scratch my head, smile, and say, somewhere over, I don't know. She's the only passenger who's ever gotten that joke. Up here, nearly everyone is miserable. I count on small joys to get by. The woman in 38C says, oh, nurse! And the woman next to her, who probably thinks we're somewhere over Idaho, that wonderland of Hemingway and golden potatoes, rolls her eyes and bangs the computer keys until the seatbelt sign goes on and the captain says, we'll be experiencing weather, which is what airline people say, instead of scary things like storms and turbulence. And pretty soon the plane is bouncing, and the woman with the computer grips her armrest while the old lady throws her arms up like she's on a roller coaster and yells, they should charge extra for this. Lori Jacquiela. Quite wonderful.
I love that.
If you've just tuned in, folks, this is KBOO Portland. The show is Poetry and Everything. Tonight's guest is A.M. O'Malley, and we are now entering the moment, beginning with this moment, when A.M. is going to give us a reading.
Yay.
So please do, out of your new book, out of stuff you're working on, tell us what we need to know.
Great.
Read to us, please.
Great. Thank you. Thank you, Judith. So I just want to read a few poems first from my book, Expecting Something Else, which, as Judith said, it's a slightly genreless book. I like to think of myself as a post-genre poet. Poetry gave me a home. And so I'm just going to read a few poems from this. And there are three segments in this book that deal with different themes, and I'm just going to read from the one that's sort of about my mother. In 1976, women were burning things, tuna casseroles, maidenform bras, their lips on roach clips. I asked her why she'd married him. The answer was something about beer and frosted mugs, older boys in high-waisted jeans with trucks, shorts, so short they required constant extraction, fishing in tapered sunlight. These answers rolled between us, clinking against our feet. What I really wanted was a jean jacket with silver studs. What I really wanted was Pony Boy, stay gold. What I really wanted was to be older in the back of someone's car. The Baptist left a bag of clothes on the stoop. The jean jacket you held up had puffed sleeves. Wrong. You took my picture in front of the foam core door. I could not possibly get what I wanted. It rained on their wedding day, Valentine's Day. She danced with her father in the Elks Lodge. She wore her veil like the one from her first Holy Communion, scalloped around her dark hair. Rain on your wedding day means good luck, travel, money, tears. My mother took a tab of acid before she knew about the baby. Then she thought she was having a boy. She dreamed of a tall, dark-haired boy. Padraig would be my name, his name. She had blue blankets for him/me, and a tiny baseball cap. When I slid to the earth 2 weeks late, suddenly in a rush and easy as a fish, I gleamed a luminous pink. My mother named me after a Grateful Dead song. First one's name, sweet Anne Marie, and she's my heart's delight. I asked her about the fire. There was soot still on the hem of her gown, the hotel window piled with wedding gifts. She had laid on the bed, drunk with her wedding. There was a fire somewhere down the hall, and people woke to thickened air. I asked about when he left her in the stairwell. She said, "Everything cannot be terrific." My bridesmaids wore dusty robes, bell sleeves, hair parted in the middle, flowing down like so many Virgin Marys. There is just one photograph. She's almost off the frame, but smiling with her eyes cast on her hand in his hand. I'll just read one more here. Or two more.
Sure.
This one I'm reading for you, Judith.
Oh, thank you already.
I was a cluster of cells, a zygote, a would-be zeitgeist, screwed into her guts. She had a tender mouth, an eye for maiden's blush, a borrowed dart, just the two of us. There's always someone who wants to unmanifest things for unmarried girls. I was conjured on a Mississippi party barge with Joe Cocker records and a raft of Southern Comfort on the rocks. I'm here to say forgetting is to gone away like a caboose is to a late-night train. On the phone, the nurse said the clinic was unmarked. She had to look for a yellow VW Beetle. Once, I caught a ladybug in my hands, legs so small they felt like a whisper. Maybe she pulled in, pulled off one mitten. Maybe she pressed a cigarette lighter, wanting smoke, the burn of something sure. Hand on a Winston, mind on her baby brother, the size of his pinky when he was born. I don't know what she said when she drove away. My ears were not shelled enough to gather sounds of that world. When I dream of my mother, her nightgown floats over my head like an idea. I jump to touch it. I know it will feel like silk, but it wafts away out of reach. Her hair runs away, too, in a wave. I reach for it, popping the joint in my shoulder. My hands splayed. Once, she asked for an impossible thing, but I don't know how people forget. How can anyone forget? Could I if I tried? I never tried at all. So that's from my book, Expecting Something Else. And so I'd just like to read a couple other things from Works in Progress, if that's okay.
Sure.
This next piece is a chapbook that I wrote, and it's a long epistolary poem. My brother Sam was born in 1992, and he was deprived of oxygen at birth, and he was brain damaged. And so this poem is really a long epistolary to him. Uh-huh. And it sort of also deals with sexual assault that I survived the week he was born. So
it was a big week in the family.
It was a big week in the family. And it's sort of a weave of those two things, and mostly just all of the things I've wanted to say to him over the years that he hasn't been able to hear. So it starts, in July of 1992, my baby brother was born brain damaged from oxygen deprivation. Dear brother, the night you were born, it was summer in Chino Valley. That night, the curly valley was a bowl of insects. I drank Fresca and counted wasps. Our mother, in another room of the house, tried to be calm. Earlier that night, in the whitest heat, I had crept to her bedroom window to watch your father try to induce her, playing with her plate-sized nipples. I was caught. You were late. We need air all the time. Getting birth is like driving a stick. Ease off the brake and clutch, push in on the gas. Someone fucked up that night in the Curly Valley. You were perfect in a new way outside of our mother. I held you when she couldn't. I didn't mind all your crying, your pulpy face, your weak neck, your soft bruised spot, and your arms raised in surrender. Your body wasn't pulled up and out. You were cut from our mother. You were pushed into the wrong doorway, fumbling with the key. Minutes are like miles. They speed past without mercy. I laid you down in the altar of my lap when you were small enough to be helped. We are dying slower than ever before. We are the sum of our proteins. We must drink water. Brother, you must drink water. We must sleep. We must lick salt. And we must stay raveled. Brother, please remember, the purpose of flying a kite is not to see a part of yourself in the sky, but to keep a hold of the string. Don't erase yourself, brother. You come from a willingness to believe that any man is good enough. I come from a willingness to believe that a baby can act as glue. These were experiments with mixed results. Here we are, half mother, half father, half creature, half seraph. You are a tooth under my scalp. You are a bone buried in my skeleton. So these are in sections, so they're numbered sections, and I'm just sort of skipping around.
Okay.
A woman on the bus said her god was the wind. She could feel it, but never see it. I thought of tornadoes. The wind has always been my enemy. But you have sails for lungs. They rise and float behind you. I drive you home. I let you keep the windows down on the highway. You could be blown away. Do you know the shape of the wind? Do you feel God there? Do you see seraphs in the clouds? I may have another 50 years to believe in something. I may step off the wrong curb before I hold you again. I held you when you were the size of a pan of lasagna. I held you when you were the size of a bag of dirt. I held you when you were the size of a bicycle. You are the size of a small car, so I will hold part of you. Our mother wanted you so badly she gave up everything else she wanted. She threw out decades of wishes for you. When you arrived and didn't know her, she went underground. She turned into a weepy chimera, split in two. We both know the shape of her hands. We know the backs of her knees. We know the tangle of her hair in the drain. Our mother gave you to me, but then she took you back. Dear brother, my birds refuse to land in the yard at the same time. They fly in circles above the lawn. You have not seen where I sleep since 1998. The trees laugh at these problems, so we cut them down. We seem together in our minds. We are far apart, but our dreams call each other collect. When you were born, I couldn't taste my own tongue, only each word. The summer gunpowder was still streaked on the driveway for independence. The wasps couldn't stop flying kamikaze into the potato salad. Freedom dragged at you like a parachute underwater. You just made it. The week you were born, I had a hypercolored t-shirt pushed up past my armpits. I had brown stick legs. I told everyone I was as old as they were. I walked to the 7-Eleven to make a call, and our mother came to get me. You were crying at home. Red clay dust clung to my shoes for years. Let's have a couple more on this one.
Mm-hmm.
Our mother taught me to turn my underwear inside out on the second day. These things happen to us. We do not give birth to ourselves. In the Curly Valley, I laid on sandy sheets. I wore that hypercolor t-shirt that belonged to the neighbor. I had white keds and kept a CoverGirl compact. I had hickeys on my neck and a spot of hymen on my jean shorts. I was killed in that bed. And lastly, from this poem, one night we will sit together like friends. Snow will fall. You will get up and put on old boots. Outside, you will drag a plastic sled to the wood pile with the dogs dancing around you. I will watch from the window as your back bends to the work of the wood. I will bring you back through the snow with my watching, back from the cord of wood, back from the hanging ice, the bottomless dusk. Love, Annie. So that's a long poem that I sort of bounced around in, and it goes here and there.
And do you consider that one done now?
That one's done. Yeah, that's a chapbook length poem.
Okay.
I feel like I can't do any more with it.
All right. Well, then it must be done.
Yeah.
This is how we know.
So this last one, you know, maybe I'm doing this out of order, but I'm reading the most recent work last.
Hey,
is that what people do? I don't know.
Order you want is the order we need.
And these poems are part of a project I've been doing with my friend Grant Gerald Miller, where we each brought a number of poems to the table, and then we did what we call translations, English to English translations of each other's work, of each other's poems. And we have 157 poems now in this series. And so he just moved to Alabama to be the Truman Capote Fellow at the University of Alabama.
That's
so, and I'm very proud of him. He was my student at one point, and then he was my co-teacher, and then collaborator, and dear, dear friend. And I'm so excited and happy for him. So we're working on finishing this book now remotely. Mm-hmm. And thankfully, he's not only is he talented, but he's also hardworking poet like me. So he's on it. I'm on it. We're finishing this book. But I just want to read a few poems, a few of my original poems. And maybe I'll read just maybe one of his translations to just show you what that looks like.
That's great, because one of the things I was just going to ask you is tell us some more about mm-hmm. what you two mean by translation English to English.
Yeah, it's very sort of Dadaist in its root. You know, sometimes people do antonymic translation, which is like the opposite translation. And some of our poems are like that. But a lot of times it's more of a conversation or a response poem. Mm-hmm. And we just call them translations as sort of a shorthand.
Okay.
But so I'll read a couple of mine and then maybe a translation or two of his, which I have asked his permission to do.
Of course you do. You know how to behave.
I do know how to behave. This one's called "I Haven't Asked You to Promise Me Anything." I have been carried back to an unremembered time before maps had been drawn, when I was not as I am now, when I was a watery milk and fetal in the street with a dewy head tucked into a paperback book. I was looked on by men as though my body was a new creation, still damp from the vast Empyrean bowl. The wonder of it infected me, so I went on car rides. Love was on the road, but not yet at the gate. I think now of a new body, precisely formed, heavy and secret with what could be. My first darling had a face that glowed in the light that came from the lamp that I could not bear to turn off. I didn't know then what love was, and I don't know now, but I smiled at him and he answered. This one's called Spring Poem, number 85. The jangling summer cut in through the basement. At this angle, I can see the big biscuits of the ridges, the hills, the silly barn, grinning with broken black teeth. I give in for a minute just to see what the world might look like from the point of view of giving up. I look at my finger, a wedding ring glints. I've been waiting for the diamond to fall out so that I can cry, so that I can press my face into the night and drink a water glass of wine, so I can get out of here, out of you. I'll read his translation of that one. Winter folds into the loft. The geometry of the city is lost on me. The infinite frozen suns burn in the windows. I don't care what the world looks like. I see it as a child choking on its wails, abandoned on a stage, blinded by a single steel beam of light. So you can see it's kind of it's very much an antonymic translation
that,
there.
Definitely that one.
Yeah. So I'll just read a couple more.
Yes,
I like this one a lot. I think I have his translation of it. Maybe not. Here it is again. From here, I see you lead life augmented by bright pleasure. Your shadow has stained the pillow on my bed. It spells out a book I read with a flashlight under the lights. I find pleasure in breaking the dreary sky with my light and my translucent eyelids and my located shoulders and my tight fist of terror. I yield to an unknown clock, the chimes, the years, an unknown dark summer. I yield. When the dark red past, shining with a spirit, closes back in on me, I will lay out the length of myself in a row on the coverlet, and I will wait for your return. Maybe I'll just try to find one where I have his translation real quick here.
Yeah, it's very cool to hear.
It's really fun, isn't it?
Or to, you know, to sense as you read.
Oh, yeah. So I definitely have this one. So I already read this one. I haven't asked you to promise me anything. So I will just read his translation, if that's okay.
Yes. So
this one, the one that I read, was the first one of this series where it was
Give us the first couple lines again. So
I've been carried back to an unremembered time before maps had been drawn. I was a watery milk, fetal in the street, dewy head packed.
Okay, and now?
And his is, I was a milky water tossed backwards, aged in the black mud, pressed between pages, blanked and hollowed out through men's mouths. I was talked at like I could destroy something, something warm and uninflicted with wonder. They put me in boats until I saw the sea as a new body, growing heavy with its secrets. Mm. So really the poems between us are, you know, translation is a very loose word. Uh-huh. It's and with our poems of the day that we've been sending back and forth, it's really like I will send him a poem first some days and he'll send me one that's definitely a response to my poem, and then the next day he might send me his poem first and I will send him back. And mm-hmm. it's turned into this thing. I mean, I don't know. Have you ever had collaborators that you write with
just
before?
A few times. I think it's really cool that you two have not created a really I was going to say crippling, that's a little mm-hmm. on the negative side, a really tight structure around this passing back and forth so that translation can mean something different.
Every time.
Virtually every time, yeah.
Truly.
A response, a rejection, mm-hmm. a rebuttal even, mm-hmm. or literally, I want to say the same thing but in different words, quote translation.
Yeah.
Yeah, very cool idea.
Yeah, I feel really lucky because I love collaboration, and it's something that it's not possible with every person. It's not mm-hmm. possible with every other artist. And so it's been working really well. And I think it helps that we've known each other for a very long time. And we worked together as teachers together. And that's a form of collaboration, of course.
Indeed. Team teaching.
Team teaching. Yes. and so it's been a great experience, and I'm excited about this project. But thank you so much for letting me read from all of my various little
Absolutely.
Lazy
that's
Susan of
that's
projects.
What this show is for.
Taking you to faraway places and bringing them home to you. Cha-cha-cha. It's the Tiki Cha-Cha Club, KBOO's all-vinyl guilty pleasure. Monday nights, midnight to 1 a.m. on 90.7 FM stereo and around the world at kboo.fm.
KBOO Community Radio is hiring. We are seeking a full-time AM News and Public Affairs Director. Applications are due by 4 p.m. Friday, September 2nd, at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, Oregon, 97214. Applications may also be emailed. Send them to hiring@kboo.org. To apply, please send both a resume and a cover letter outlining your skills and experience with regard to the minimum qualifications. And please answer the question, why is KBOO important? For more information and a full job description, go to kboo.fm/AM News. KBOO is an equal opportunity and affirmative action employer. Women and people of color are encouraged to apply. Again, that's kboo.fm/AM News. And thank you.
Folks who have just tuned in, first of all, you missed one of the best parts, possibly the best part, but stay with us because there's going to be good stuff after. This is KBOO Portland. The show is Poetry and Everything. I'm Judith Arcana, and the guest tonight is A.M. O'Malley. So now I have, as is my job, questions for you.
All right.
And the first one, I think in some ways grows out of the choices that you made and certainly your new book. So here it is. Many people think that poetry is by definition autobiographical. And your new book, Expecting Something Else, this is now available, folks, for your purchase and reading pleasure, Expecting Something Else by A.M. O'Malley. Your new book is certainly defined and described in this way. Mm-hmm. However, this is what I want you to think about. Sterling A. Brown, who was a major player in the Harlem Renaissance, born in 1901, said that poetry is not self-expression. The I is a dramatic I. Mm-hmm. And much later, Andrew Hudgens
poet and teacher born 50 years later, said, let me get this right, the speakers in poems are not real people. They are all creations of the writer, aspects of the writer's mind. Even when I try as hard as I can to write as myself, I know that the I speaking is a persona, a subset of myself, some part that cannot hold the entirety of my experiences, my understandings, my ambivalences. And setting aside the fact that both of these guys are Southerners, and get this, so, of course, it's Adrienne Rich, also born in the South, and she strongly agreed with them. It was from her that I first, years and years and years ago, began to think about this thing. So what do you think about this? You've just been writing these things. You know, what do you think about the changes, the differences between you, the real person writing, and these personae who are speaking in your work?
Well, I have to say, I absolutely agree, and it's a big part of why I don't call this book a memoir, because it's not a memoir. I tried to write it as a memoir, and I was not able to achieve the emotional cut or hit that I wanted to without taking on the persona of the I, the dramatic I. And so poetry gave me the freedom, because the speaker, the I of the speaker, did not need to be A.M. O'Malley. And for an informed reader, I think, of poetry, they understand that. And, I mean, there's certainly people who read this book and they take it as journalism and connect with me at that level. And I'm ready and willing to do that. That's fine. But truly, I chose this form and I chose poetry for that exact reason that you just cited, which is that you know, there's things that take place in the book that happened before I was born, you know, family lore, all of these things that in order for me to create a thread and create a whole of what I wanted to do, I had to step into another realm of persona. And so, it gave me a freedom that I needed in order to get at the emotional truths. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely. I think about this a lot. I know many writers do. We're hardly unique here. In this particular book, not the exchange between you and your pal, the Truman Capote fellow, but this in the new book, do you think of do you think that there's one speaker and she's the one talking throughout? Or do you think that even though there is what you could call, quote unquote, a plot, you know, a history moving forward through time, that there's, is there more than one? Is there one? How do you, or do you even care about that?
Well, I certainly think in expecting something else, that there is also the voice of character of the mother. But it's a little bit of a third-person point of view with her. There is definitely a first-person speaker voice that is the most prevalent thread through the book. But there's also, in many places, the point of view of this other character. So I think there are two voices, and there's a real tension there. There's also a tension, of course, between the speaker and the poet, too, that I think is evident on the page.
That's important to point out.
Yeah. So in a way, there are two main points of view, but there's also that tension between those two and the poet, who
Thank
is me.
Another thing I'm interested in terms of that particular book is the two, what I think of as the primary forms in it. The erasure poems, which of course have visuals, imagery attached, and the, what I think of as the solid blocks of prose poetry. So talk to us a bit about the choice to do those two forms and to put them together. And sometimes they are facing each other, facing pages, and sometimes not. So talk about that, please.
Sure. Thank you. So the erasures all come from the same book, which is a book by Nancy Friday, which was published in 1979. You may be familiar. called My Mother, Myself. It's like a very early proto self-help book. And I found myself actually after I had finished the manuscript for Expecting Something Else and after it had been accepted for publication, making these erasures every day from the same battered paperback of my mother, myself. And it was sort of like a, in a way, it was a way for me to resolve some things or to create a new voice. And then my publisher asked me if I wanted to include photographs in the book. My publisher, University of Hell, they really like to have visual elements in their books. And I wasn't willing to share photos because of what you actually already addressed, which is the idea of the persona and the eye. And I wanted there to be a little bit more distance. And so I offered up the erasures instead, which are very visual. And then it just worked out very well that they were also along the theme of the mother and the daughter and the self. It just was sort of this very, I don't want to say lucky, but I guess some place in my brain I wasn't done and I was still working through. And so I was making all of these erasures and then they ended up working really well to be interspersed with the book. So I just chose 10. I made probably 75.
Whoa.
Yeah. Oh, and I think I only chose like 10 or 12. And I didn't actually choose where they would be in the book. The publisher did, or my editor did, John Barrios, who I love. And then the prose blocks, that was a very long process. I went through a lot of different forms, and in the end, you know, I'm traditionally, my background is in prose writing. I've always been a prose writer, although that feels very distant from me now. And so this book originally was a lot of like little short stories. And so I wanted to get away from that as much as I could without losing the little nuggets. I thought of them as little nuggets of story. And so my publisher suggested I take out all the punctuation to give them a more nonlinear sort of lyric feel. Mm-hmm. And it was really scary. but I am willing to take creative risks. Mm-hmm. So I sent the manuscript without punctuation to a few people I trust. And I said, you know, what do you think of this? And they were like, yeah, it works. And so I went with it. And I feel good about it now.
Yeah, I think you should. First of all, it's visually arresting, to me anyway, as a reader and viewer. Mm-hmm. It's extremely appealing looking. Also, I think the great good luck, the great good fortune of having editors and publishers mm-hmm. that we can talk to about the meaning, the nuance, you know, everything about the work. And when they say to us, well, why don't you think about this? We don't have to run around screaming, oh, my, what are you? But instead think, huh, well, maybe I'll try that.
Mm-hmm.
I'll never forget the first time that happened, which was also with my first full-length collection of poems. The editor / publisher said to me, well, what did you mean in the – and I thought, oh, what did I mean? Oh, I said what I mean. You know, I was like, well, you said you wanted to publish this. And blah, 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 this is all going on in the back of my brain yeah. while I'm talking to her on the phone. And after a while, I thought, whoa, what a gift. This is so lucky. First of all, this woman's so intelligent, blah, blah. And it made a tremendous difference in my life and in my poems, and also helped me to choose which one's in, which mm-hmm. one's out. So, yeah, I definitely know what you're talking about. It's very lucky to work with folks that
truly
we can think and feel that way mm-hmm. about. Yeah. Well, thank you for telling us about that. Now, this is the sort of a more generic, or at least a more general question about decisions and choices that you make while you're writing. Something that interests me not only in my own work, but in the work of others, of course. Times that maybe you started with a theme or topic, times maybe you started with a form. And, you know, these work really differently. Have you given a much thought to that? How has that worked for you? For example, a writer might think, I want to do a zine. I want it pocket size. I want it illustrated with poems on opposite pages, from, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And then think, now, which poems, what subject, you know, that kind of thing. So what do you think?
Man, you know, so I have a very recursive process with my writing where it just never ends.
Well, that's a good thing. That's knock on wood.
Yeah,
right,
knock on wood. I hope it never ends. And I talked. I like. There's an anecdote I like to talk about to my students a lot, which is that there's sort of a myth or a story about Monet getting kicked out of the Louvre for touching up one of his own paintings. And that's sort of the approach I have with my work. And so I may often start, expecting something else is a great example, because in the beginning it was a specific theme, a specific form that I was wholly committed to for years. And then I went on a residency for a month and everything fell apart. And I got to see the scope of the manuscript, and I realized that the form didn't work, and I needed to, if I wanted to get at the story that I wanted to get at, I had to really radically shake things up and change everything. And so it was a great lesson for me in terms of form and theme and process, because I just sort of learned to trust that the form will sort of choose me. One of my favorite writers, Maggie Nelson, who wrote a book called Bluettes, and she wrote Argonauts, and she basically, she's a poet, but she's also a philosopher, academic, and critical thinker, and she, all of her books are all in different form, and people ask her about that a lot there, you know, because people want to put you in a category.
Yes. Where will you go on the shelves?
Yes, exactly. Where will we put you? And she often talks about this thing of what, you know, she just lets the form sort of rise up or choose her. And so I try to embody that too in terms of themes and form and all of that. And I try to let it be a more organic process. Mm-hmm. So for example, you know, expecting something else is in little prose blocks without punctuation. Dear Brother, which is a book length epistolary in numbered sections. I mean, I had never even seen that before. I don't know if it exists beyond this, but it's what works. And then the shifting Riverbanks of Ourselves, which is the working title of the last book, is very traditional line break poems that are, you know, also in an insane way being translated by another poet, but you know, so all of those forms really just sort of rose up out of the process, out of the work, right, and out of the content of the work. Mm-hmm. I don't know if that answers your question
Well.
Well,
pretty much anything that you would say that was real about your thinking and your process would answer the question. But yeah, for sure.
Great, right.
Okay, this one may seem obvious, but I have to ask about connections and relationships between your work as a writer and your work at the IPRC.
Sure.
And, I mean, this, obviously the IPRC is many, many things, and one of them is a place where people work with words.
Mm-hmm.
And here you are, this writer person and mm-hmm. teacher person, and
how's that going for you?
Well, I often think about the fact that I spend at least 40 hours a week facilitating other people's creativity. And then I have to reserve some energy and some space to facilitate my own creativity. And it's taken a lot, and I'm not always good at it, and it's taken a lot of work to have that discipline for that process. You know, I won't lie to you, Judith, and
that's
I would sometimes I think, man, it would be so much easier if I was just a waitress again. You know, I spent 15 years as a waitress, and I would go home and I would write, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. and in my job now during the day, I'm being creative. I'm helping other people fulfill their creative goals. And sometimes I feel like it can really deplete my own creative process. Mm-hmm. And so it's been a, you know, and that said, I would not trade my job. I love my job. I love all the people I work with. I love being surrounded by people who are driven by the creative impulse and urge. But that is sort of a balancing act I have to do. And it's not always easy.
No, I think it's probably never easy.
No.
I mean, certainly teachers argue about this or discuss it anyway, mm-hmm. that are we depleting ourselves of our creative energy at the same time that, you know, I mean, I taught for about 40 years in various places and ways, and I loved teaching. But there's no question that I didn't get to write as much as I wanted to, poetry, prose, you know, whatever the forms might have been, because I was using myself, my creative energy, in the way that you were talking about, in this other way. Okay. And the IPRC, this also makes me think about your new book. The IPRC is a place that deals not only with words, but also with forms and pictures, so to speak, formats, because it's about publication in addition to fostering the creation of the words themselves, the putting together of words themselves. Pretty cool place.
Thank you.
Looking forward to wherever the new home happens to be.
Yeah.
The IPRC is moving, folks. We'll have no doubt news about that later.
Yeah.
But not on this show.
Yeah.
Okay. Another question. What... this is sort of the classic, or one of the classic questions. What poets and or poems have been particularly useful or important to you, and maybe at different times in your life as a reader and writer?
Sure.
And so talk about that, how and why those particular poets and poems.
Well, when I first discovered poetry, I, Denise Levitov, Adrienne Rich, Robert Lowell, Robert Creeley, Theodore Retke, they were really important. That whole school was a real great gateway for me into poetry. And after that, I really became sort of a voracious reader of poetry, and I read a lot of contemporary poets, and lately I've been getting very much into a lot of Southern poets, the Wrights, Charles Wright, James Wright, Franz Wright, C.D. Wright, there's only two there that are related, but they're all from the South.
It's a regional name.
Yeah, it must be. Frank Stanford has been a huge influence on me in the last couple of years. His collected work just came out a couple years ago, and it's been a touchstone for me. I also just, in general, love a lot of the work that Tavern Books, which is a local poetry press here, puts out.
Back to us.
I'm a subscriber with them, and so I get, whenever they publish a new book, it comes to my door, and I just read a book called Breaking the Barricade by a Polish poet, and I'm blanking on her name, but it was devastating, beautiful work. When I was 7 years old, I tried to memorize a Tennyson poem. So I've always had sort of an inkling towards that. I love putting poems in my body, which is my way of saying memorizing poems. I host a monthly event called Other People's Poems at Mother Foucault's, which is on the third Friday of every month. And it's a recitation event. It's free, open to the public. And it's at 7 p.m. every third Friday. And you just come, you show up, and you recite a poem that you have memorized.
Poems.
Other people's poems,
love
always.
It, which is why I start the show with that.
Yes, I love
some
that.
Years back, I decided I would start every reading with something by someone else.
I love that.
As to have the exchange.
Yeah.
And also, of course, to just get as much as we possibly can.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So and Emily Dickinson. I have to shout out to Emily Dickinson, too, of course, because I just love. And Walt Whitman, too. Yeah. I mean, the proto-modernists that they are, I really, their work is very important. It would be hard for me actually to stop once I start talking about poets that I love.
So all right, I'll
stop
you
there.
I'll stop you. I'll ask one more question.
Okay.
And we're just about out of time anyway. What are you reading now, if there's something that you haven't mentioned? Why did you choose it, and what do you think about it?
Well, I just finished a book by Joe Wilkins, book of poems. And it's his latest book. It won an award. It was chosen by Billy Collins. I'm so bad at names, Judith.
Oh,
I'm sorry.
Matter.
But I do remember his name. And I loved it because he wrote it primarily in the Midwest, upper Midwest, where I'm from. And it made me feel incredibly homesick. A lot of it is very rich in place. And, pastoral can be sort of derogatory, but in the most positive way is pastoral. And he does a really great job of coming close in and then moving far back in the work. And so I love that. I actually happened to get the book because we read together at Powell's when my book came out, and they just sort of pair you with other poets, you know. And he was so nice, and I got his book because, you know, that's what you do. And then it sat on my shelf. And then my friend, who also went to the reading, had picked the book up and was like, "Hey, did you read this book?" And I was like, "Oh, no, but I will." And then I read it in a day, and I was like, "Oh, my God." So I just finished that a day or so ago and loved it. But I'm also reading David Bojanovich, which is – so he's not necessarily a poet. He wrote a memoir called Close to the Knives. He died of AIDS in the 80s, and he's also a visual artist, and his work has been really influential on me in the last few months. Just his images are incredibly vibrant and – powerful.
All right.
Yeah.
Well, thank you very much. And
thank you, Judith,
for being on the show.
Of course. Thank you so much.
For sitting here and talking with me and talking to everyone out there who's listening to us talk to each other and them as well.
Yes.
So, folks, next month's Poetry and Everything will air at 10 p.m. on September 26th, the fourth Monday of the month. That's our time. And we'll talk more then about Poetry and Everything. In the meantime, thank you for listening. And remember, support independent bookstores, independent reading series, and independent radio.
Yay!
Good night.
Good night.
It's today, all of yesterday dropped away among the fingers of the light and the sleeping eyes. Tomorrow will come on its green footsteps. No one can stop the river of the dawn. No one can stop the river of your hands, your eyes and their sleepiness, my dearest. You are the trembling of time, which passes between the vertical light and the darkening sky. That is why I sing to the day and to the moon, to the sea, to time, to all the planets, to your daily voice, to your nocturnal scheme. The river.